We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
You know, one of the differences between the U.S. and the old Soviet Union that I remember is the image that in the Soviet Union, the people didn't hear the truth. They heard propaganda. So-called facts that came down from the top, facts that were fit to a policy, a pre-existing policy that weren't really necessarily facts at all, but they were twisted to fit to what the government wanted the people of the Soviet Union to believe. We in the United States were nothing like that. We had freedom of the press here. We didn't have a government twisting the news and giving us an official news. That was Pravda. That wasn't the United States. Well, you know, it looks like maybe things have changed, not for the better, but that propaganda may be sneaking in and taking over the mainstream media. Propaganda from the top down. And we're going to talk today about that situation with a focus on one specific case. You may remember in the summer of 2014, Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, which we'll also call MH17, was a scheduled international passenger flight that was going from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur. It crashed on July 17, 2014, after being shot down, killing all 283 passengers and 15 crew on board. The Boeing 777 lost contact about 31 minutes from the Ukraine-Russian borders. Just 3 days after the crash, our Secretary of State, John Kerry, assured the world that the plane was shot down by pro-Russian insurgents using a Buk BUK surface-to-air missile fired from the territory which the Russians controlled. The Russian government, in turn, blamed the Ukrainian government. Now, the Dutch Safety Board is still investigating the situation, and their final accident report is expected in October of 2014. Could it be that Secretary of State John Kerry, quote, fixed the intelligence around a policy? That is the concern of our guest today, former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. Thanks very much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
You're most welcome, Bert.
Well, most troubling about this is the very quick finger-pointing of blame at Putin's Russia. And this facts and information perhaps has been used not to inform, but as our guest Ray McGovern says, to advance some propaganda objective. Sounds to me like the old Soviet Union that we were not like. In other words, instead of policy following legitimate information, perhaps information was formed to fit a preconceived policy. That is some scary stuff. That is a real assault on democracy. An essential ingredient in democracy is public access to the truth, to facts. It is different forms of government that give out propaganda and demand the media and public accept it as truth and not question the official line. Ray McGovern works with Tell the World, the publishing arm of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C. During his career as CIA analyst, he prepared and briefed the president's daily brief and chaired National Intelligence Estimates. He knows his stuff. He's a member of the steering group of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. His article on the shooting down of MH17 is in Consortium, titled Propaganda, Intelligence, and MH17. Well, again, thanks for being with us, Ray McGovern. It all seems so cut and dried, and it made sense. Either the Russians or the Russian-backed and directed rebels in eastern Ukraine were the ones who shot down that passenger set. But you say there was actually, quote, intense pressure to choreograph the judgments to the propagandistic music, which favored by senior officials who want the U.S. enemy, in this case, a nuclear-armed Russia and its Western demonized President Vladimir Putin, to somehow be responsible, unquote. It seems hard to believe, for me, that our government would not do a proper intelligence analysis before laying any blame. Why would there be that pressure to shape intelligence to fit political wants when this all came down?
Well, Bert, the primary objective of our government at that time, and to a large degree still now, was to blacken Russia, to make Vladimir Putin a pariah. And this was a glorious opportunity to do precisely that. What happened was John Kerry got up 3 days, as you mentioned, 3 days after the shootdown. The shootdown was on a Thursday, I remember. I was in Tennessee at the time, and I wrote an article right away which said, hey, we need facts before anything else on this. And what we got was not really facts from John Kerry, but rather information that he said was based on social media, which he described to David Gregory as, quote, an extraordinary tool, end quote. Well, as an old professional intelligence analyst, you know, I'm prompted to ask, a tool for what, you know? Social media is a very thin reed to rely on, the more so when you have incredible sophisticated devices, what we call national technical means, meaning, of course, satellites of all sizes and descriptions,
mm-hmm.
Imagery satellites, communication intercepts, you name it, we've got it. And they were all focused specifically on that part of the Russia-Ukraine border at precisely that time.
So, you would think, yeah.
As an intelligence analyst who knew what was available back when I retired and can only assume that even those sophisticated systems, those collection systems, have since been improved, there's no doubt in my mind that intelligence analysts in our government know exactly what happened, know who shot the plane down, and when and how, and that they have told their policymakers. Now, it may not have been all that clear 3 days after the after the event,
really?
But why did John Kerry decide to rush to judgment? Why did he adduce all these very ephemeral social media sources to blacken Putin, to say the Russians and the pro-Russian separatists were to blame? Well, let me just make one sort of a detour here and talk about this label, pro-Russian separatists.
Sure, that's a good point, yeah.
Very, very clever. Are they separatists? No. However much they would like to join Russia, the Russians wouldn't have them, and Putin made that clear from the very start. Okay, so separatists is not quite the word. It's people who want some degree of regional autonomy. And the pro-Russian, well, most of them are from Russian stock, but that's not really relevant here. The relevant factor, the operative factor, is the fact that their duly elected president, Yanukovych, was ousted in a U.S. and Western-sponsored coup on the 22nd of February. The coup leaders and the new people installed by our government immediately said, well, let's get Ukraine as part of NATO, and let's ban Russian as an official language in Ukraine, So these folks are anti-coup federalists, not pro-Russian separatists, okay? Anyhow, they were blamed for this on the basis of very, very ephemeral evidence, so much so that even the the note takers, the transcribers of government statements, the stenographers, is the right word,
in
the mainstream media, even they had some questions. And so 2 days later emerged a call to some carefully selected mainstream journalists. We're going to give you a little briefing and tell you about what happened. Well, the briefing was made available in a very short little memo called a government assessment.
Right. I was going to ask about that. And if I may, there's this new creation, a government assessment. It used to be something, as you write, called an intelligence assessment. What does this absence of an intelligence assessment indicate?
The explanation is really very interesting. In my day, and even more recently, when a major incident like this occurred, the intelligence community would be asked to perform an assessment. It would be coordinated among, well, then there were 12, now there are 16 separate and independent sort of intelligence agencies in the U.S. government. And then it would be given to the president and say, this is the intelligence assessment. And more likely than not, he would make that available to the mainstream press. Well, this is the second time that this new genre, this new animal called a government assessment, has been used to justify what I think are lies. Let's be upfront about what I think they're lies.
Mm-hmm.
The first time came when John Kerry got up before the press at the State Department on the 30th of August 2013 and said, we know that it was Bashar al-Assad and his government that launched those chemical attacks outside Damascus on the 21st of August. We know. 35 times he said, we know.
Mm.
I recall, Shakespeare's dictum,
yes.
Methinks he doth protest to us.
Exactly.
Anyhow, he
thinking,
didn't
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
He was fed a bunch of lies, perhaps, and to excuse him, but he was spewing out disinformation. It was not Bashar al-Assad's government. Now, why do I mention that? Well, I mention that because that was the first time this new genre, this new animal of a, quote, government assessment, end quote, was put forth to substitute for the normal intelligence assessment. Why is that important? Well, that's important because we knew then, in August, September of 2013, just as we know now with respect to the shootdown over Ukraine, that our former colleagues have protested and said, look, you're not going to enlist us, you're not going to suborn us and corrupt us into supporting U.S. policy by fraudulent intelligence. We don't have to do that anymore. You see what happened in Iraq? That was not a mistake. That was fraud. And our colleagues did that. We're not going to do it anymore.
Yeah.
So you get not an intelligence assessment, but a government. That's really important. That shows that there are certain limits on what the government can do with intelligence anymore, even though it feels free to concoct additional evidence based on social media. But the thing is that unless we get a whistleblower or two within the intelligence community to say exactly what they have in terms of very sophisticated, very precise, very persuasive evidence of who shot that plane down, and we're still going to be asked to rely on the social media cited by Kerry on the 20th of July, 2014, and then, quote, supported, end quote, by the government assessment 2 days later. So the mainstream press got their, quote, corroboration, end quote, of what Kerry said. But that statement, that government assessment, didn't go any farther than Kerry's evidence did in terms of justifying the line he took. Now, These things are, you know, can be looked at as sort of debating points. But some events like this, Bert, are consequential.
Yes.
And what I mean is this. At the time, the U.S. was, as I said, trying to blacken Russia, trying to blame it for all manner of things, including what it was doing in Ukraine, even though that was all provoked by the coup that we arranged on the 22nd of February. Let me, you know, before I forget to tell you this, George Friedman, who runs Stratfor, it's a very good analytic organization. As a matter of fact, people say it's sort of the civilian CIA because it does a lot of the work that analysts in CIA used to do. Well, what he said last December was that the coup in Kiev on the 22nd of February 2013 was the most blatant coup in the history of mankind. God, what do you mean by that?
Yeah.
Well, this is really important to know. You don't see it in the mainstream media. You know, people say, you know, the revolution will not be televised, right? Okay.
It'll be on social media.
This coup was YouTubized 2 weeks before it.
What do you mean by that?
Pardon?
What do you mean by that? It was YouTube.
Well, what I mean
2 weeks before?
That the Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland,
yes,
was on the phone with our ambassador in Kiev. And what she said, and this is virtually a direct quote, let Klitschko and those others wait in the wings. Yats is our guy. He knows about the central bank. He knows about austerity measures. Yats is our guy. Now, that was intercepted, I don't know by whom, perhaps the Russian service. It was put up on YouTube the first week of February. And all I'm saying here is that, you know, that being the case, In the past, at least, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind, so to speak, would sort of disqualify Yats from becoming prime minister. Yats, of course, stands for Yatsenyuk. And the next day, or not the next day, but 2 weeks later, on the 22nd of February, he became the new prime minister.
Surprise,
and guess
surprise.
Who is the prime minister now?
Yeah, I'm guessing. Yats. Yes.
So I wrote an article the next day. Saying, yikes, it's Yats, and it was Yats, and it is Yats, and Yats is the guy, our man in Kiev. So the point of what I'm saying is that it was so blatant, and George Friedman is referring to it as the most blatant coup in the history of mankind for precisely that reason. It was not televised, but it was YouTubeized in advance, and we went ahead anyway. Talk about arrogance, and talk about the cooperation of the mainstream media. You don't see that in the mainstream media.
No.
For what we see in the Washington Post and the New York Times always starts with the, quote, invasion of Ukraine, the seizure of Crimea, as though that happened out of the blue.
Mm.
And, you know, it's...
Russian imperialism, right?
It's quite remarkable. You know, you said at the outset that media and what the media has become in this country is quite remarkable.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've been here 52 years, so I've seen a lot of change in Washington. But the most significant, you know, the most important change that I've witnessed is simply the fact that we no longer have, in any real sense, a free media. That's big.
Yeah.
That's by far the... That dwarfs all the other changes. I mean, remember Thomas Jefferson when he's asked, if you only had one or the other, what would you choose, a government or a free press?
Right.
In those days, of course, it was all newspapers.
Yeah.
And he said, are you kidding? Of course, a free press. A government without a free press would be a dictator overnight.
Right.
So we no longer have that. That's the bad news. The Fourth Estate is dead. The good news, of course, is that there are programs like yours, and there's the internet, the web,
yes,
and people can really find out what's going on if they have the time and if they take the trouble
to
look and to find places where they can get real information. Those are big ifs. Lots of people have two jobs, three jobs these days.
Right.
You know, they feed the kids at night, and they put their feet up on the couch, and they tune into Fox News to be entertained, not to be informed.
I know. Wow, this is big stuff here. If you just tuned in, we are keeping democracy alive. You, the listener, are part of keeping democracy alive. It does take some effort. Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is noted former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. And we're talking about what's happened to information, real information in America. And the example we're using is largely the shoot down of the Malaysian passenger jet in July of 2014 and the official handout from there. I find it fascinating. We're talking about new media a little bit. Social media. I mean, what I think of as social media is, you know, Twitter, Facebook, stuff like that, YouTube. And John Kerry cited social media as the source to verify that the Russians or their puppets in eastern Ukraine shot down that plane. I'm sorry, but isn't social media more than a little questionable and highly unreliable? One would think that our highly capable intelligence gathering sources would have been focusing on the area. Wouldn't there be interceptions of electronic transmissions as well as information from actual human assets sources on the ground? Surely the Obama administration must have gone beyond social media to actually blame the Russians, or are they just looking at that? And further, if there were all these, you know, people on the ground, wouldn't somebody be speaking up now if they had been lied to and manipulated?
Well, they would have, Bert, if they had access to media. Now, you have to look long and far to find media clips of revealing detail other than what has appeared in the mainstream media,
so to speak.
But there were several eyewitnesses right in that part of Ukraine. But what they didn't see was a Vuk missile going up to shoot down that plane. What they saw was one or possibly two Ukrainian Su-25s headed in the direction of the plane.
Hmm.
Now, Russian radar data shows a plane up there near the MH-17 that was shot down. One can say, well, you can't trust that. But number one, why was it flying over this area of hostilities? And number two, why is it that we don't really have a good definitive analysis of, for example, the cockpit section of the plane? Some of the Ukrainian and some of the international inspectors immediately pointed out that it looked like there was cannon fire. There were cannon bullets going into that section of the plane that would have come from a plane like the Su-25. Well, immediately, the Ukrainian government said, look at that, this spurious report. Su-25s can't reach 30,000 feet. What are you doing, okay? Well, they can, okay? And I just found a Ukrainian brag sheet in which they indicate, yes, they've improved the Su-25 to the point where it can go to 10,000 meters, which is 33,000 feet. So there's so much misinformation that the notion that John Kerry is asking us to depend on social media, as he did in accusing the Syrian government of perpetrating those chemical attacks outside Damascus at the in the middle of August of 2013, has he no shame? Has the director of national intelligence, a fellow named Clapper?
Oh yes.
Yeah, whose record for credibility is not really that good, since he lied under oath when asked if NSA was intercepting any of our telephone calls.
Oh, yeah.
Well, this is the same guy. He lied under oath, but he's still the director of national intelligence. Who's to believe here? Why do people put in credence in this kind of thing? It's quite amazing to me, because I know for sure that the U.S. government has a bevy of information on all this. And for Clapper's office to turn investigative journalists away, as I have my colleague Bob Perry, who is the chief editor of ConsortiumNews.com, on the pretense that they haven't learned a thing that's relevant since the 22nd of July, 5 days after the shootdown. They're still relying on social media. This is not credible, as Bob would gently say. It's a lie, as McGovern would say. So the question is, if they have more information, and I'm sure they do, why don't they make it available? And you don't have to be a crackerjack analyst to reason that the reason they don't make it available is because it gives the lie to what Kerry said 3 days after the shootdown. Now, is this a big deal? You bet it's a big deal.
Yeah.
Because the U.S. did this not only to blacken Putin, but also to persuade the Europeans, gullible as they are, or pressurable as they are, I suppose is a better word, to institute biting economic sanctions within 2 weeks, okay? So the shootdown and the information given about the shootdown with respect to culpability on the part of the Russians or the edgy coup federalists out there in the eastern Ukraine, that was used to harm not only the Russian economy, but the economies of Europe, which are sort of still struggling to come out of the recession, okay? So this is a big deal. And if it becomes known, as I hope some courageous analyst from our intelligence community lets it be known, if it becomes known that Kerry was lying on the 20th of July, 2014, just as he was on August 30th, 2013, then all hell will break loose in Western Europe if they have any independence at all, and the people will be a little bit upset because they have suffered on the end of these sanctions in a way that the U.S. has not suffered. So it's a big deal.
Yeah, it certainly is. And, you know, there are a lot of people in the intelligence community. As you said, it used to be 12 agencies, now it's 16. That's a lot of people. It's kind of challenging for me to believe that this intelligence data could be manipulated, information specifically left out, without somebody. I mean, all these people must know better. Is it that they are bullied? That they're, I mean, it's a brave thing. Edward Snowden did a very, very brave thing. Some people hate him. Some people think he's a hero. It was a brave thing to risk, and I mean, his life, really, to come out and tell the truth. Is that part of it, that there's this just kind of built-in intimidation that the government, Kerry, and the people behind this story recognize that nobody's going to have the guts to come out and put their jobs on the line, or maybe even more?
Well, you know, being an intelligence analyst, I can kind of make surmises that I might be able not to produce a piece of paper for. But when you consider that the Obama administration has prosecuted more whistleblowers under the old Espionage Act of right around World War One.
Yes, 1918.
They have prosecuted more whistleblowers than all other previous presidents put together. You wonder why this is. Why the Army comes out with a report last week saying, you know, journalists, you know, they could be regarded as belligerents in some cases, you know. Why is it that there is this repressive atmosphere? Well, it's precisely to deter people from doing what Edward Snowden did, to his great credit in revealing how the NSA was playing fast and loose with the Fourth Amendment to our Constitution. There aren't too many people with the courage to do what Snowden did.
Sure.
He recognized that it was likely that he'd spend the rest of his life behind bars and is feeling very, very, very lucky right now, which he is. But there are precious few people who take that risk. Now, that doesn't mean there are none, and that doesn't mean it can't be done. You just have to know how to go about it, like Ed Snowden learned from watching others that were persecuted, like Tom Drake and Bill Binney from NSA, and he knew, for example, he had to get out of Dodge.
Yeah.
He couldn't stay in the U.S. if he was to achieve his mission and to have some hope of eluding jail, at least straight away. So, yeah, it takes a special person, but that doesn't mean that there aren't such people, and it doesn't mean that it can't be done. Now, with WikiLeaks and the various sophisticated ways that people can reveal this information, there are ways that the people can be reasonably sure they won't get caught. Do I encourage that? Of course I do.
Yeah.
Because I swore one oath, and that is to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I didn't swear an oath to keep secrets that reveal gross violations of that Constitution. And that's exactly how those NSA folks and Ed Snowden feel about it. What I try to resist is calling them heroes. And I think you'll understand this, Bert. Once you set somebody up as a hero, and Dorothy Day is one of my models on this, she says, do not pedestalize me. Do not dismiss me so readily. Don't call me a heroine, okay?
Mm.
Once you put somebody up on the pedestal of a hero, then people will say, well, yeah, that's really great that they did this, but I can't do something like that. I'm not a hero.
Uh-huh.
These guys are not heroes. They're patriots.
Yes.
They took a solemn oath to the Constitution.
Yes.
Just as I did, just as millions of others have. And they had the guts to point out how our Constitution was being grossly violated.
We are trying to keep a democracy alive. And what that means is maintaining our Republican form of government, which is based on a constitution. It's not based on specific leaders. And what you say about using the Sedition Act of the First World War, that was a terrible act, which really many people think in of itself was a terrible violation of our constitution. And the fact that Obama has been using that so much, that is a real threat to democracy. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is noted retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who knows what he's talking about. We're talking specifically using the case of the shooting down of the Malaysian jet over Ukraine in the summer of 2014 and looking at, in general, the erosion of freedom of the press here, and the press being manipulated, much like we saw the old Soviet Union doing. Now, with regard to this particular plane, we know 298 lives were lost. The plane was indeed shot out of the sky. Let's look at motivations. I mean, we heard there were rumors that some people thought Putin was in that plane, and that he was flying at that time. It was suggested that the plan around the attack might have been to take down the plane with Putin in it. The red and blue stripe design on the Malaysian airline planes are very similar to Putin's presidential airplane. You've probably heard stories of a threat by a regional governor whose name I could not pronounce, quite frankly, and the oligarch Kolmanovsky, who promised a ransom of $1 million for killing Putin. But wouldn't Putin be rather stupid to fly over Ukraine in that situation? What do you know about such theories there?
Well, Bert, Putin is not stupid.
Right.
I can't conceive of him flying anywhere near the area of those hostilities. So these were rumors. The coincidence and the painting on the plane, well, you know, you can't see the colors with a Vuk missile, if that's what it was. You could see it with an Su-25, but I tend to rule that out. It could be that whoever shot down the Malaysian plane thought they were targeting Putin's plane, but I can't believe he was anywhere in the area.
Right. So who would have the motivation to shoot down that plane? You know, Kerry obviously said the Russians shot down the plane, and it's obvious what that did as a propaganda victory of sorts. What are your, from your knowledge of intelligence gathering and what, you know, the politics of Ukraine at the time with this U.S.-imposed coup, why would somebody shoot down that plane?
This is This is really a tough question because we don't know who did it. And the U.S. government knows, but the U.S. government made a very early decision to poison the jury pool, so to speak, to rush to judgment and accuse the Russians. And to this day, 13 months later, they have not adduced persuasive proof. This suggests to me that it's a no-brainer.
Hmm.
That the evidence they have from satellite and other sophisticated collection means, which were focused laser-like on that part of the Ukraine and Russia in those days, that the evidence from that does not support the charges that either the Russians or the pro-Russian separatists, if you want to use that term, were guilty. Now, you know, the day after, well, the day of the shoot-down, that was July 17, 2013, I was off in Tennessee somewhere, and I took the morning off from the seminar that I was attending, and I wrote an article about this thing. And what it reminded me of was the shoot-down of KAL-007.
Refresh your memories.
Yeah, some of your folks will remember, on September 1, during the Reagan administration, September 1, 1983, a Soviet fighter jet shot down a Korean airline plane, KAL-007, after it strayed hundreds of miles off course, penetrated some of the Soviet Union's most sensitive airspace, military facilities in Kamchatka and Sakhalin Island. Okay, so when it was finally intercepted, the pilot tried to signal to the plane to land. But the pilot didn't respond. And after he circled around, dipped his wings and all, he got orders from ground control to blast it out of the sky, partly because a U.S. intelligence collector, an RC-135, had been flying the same path just a little while before, several hours before. So now, how many people? I think there were maybe 269 people aboard. That's what I remember. On board, they were killed. Now, what happened? Well, to make the very blackest case against the Soviets in those days, the Reagan administration suppressed evidence that was exculpatory, okay, in favor of a really, really, well, you know, you lie in diplomacy and your life for advantage. But even I was sort of disgusted by it. What they did, they developed this mantra. It was something like, it was almost like a dactylic hexameter from the Iliad or the Odyssey, and it went like this. Quote, the deliberate downing of a civilian passenger plane. The deliberate downing of a civilian passenger plane. You got it? Deliberate downing of a civilian passenger plane. Newsweek had a cover. Murder in the sky, okay? Now, I know a little bit about what actually happened, but was not able to really comment very much on it until Alvin A. Snyder, then director of the USIA, that's U.S. Information Agency's TV division, wrote about the incident in his 1995 book, which he called Warriors of Disinformation. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So, short story, he was appointed with others by USIA Director Charles Z. Wick, people remember him,
oh, sure,
to heap as much abuse on the Soviet Union as possible. You know, it was really a coup in American media that the venerable Ted Koppel on ABC,
yes,
taking his stenographic notes from the government, mm-hmm, and I quote, "This has been one of those occasions when there is very little difference between what is churned out by U.S. government propaganda organs and what we are seeing in the commercial broadcasting networks," end quote. In other words, you know, who's to doubt this? I, Ted Koppel, put my name under this. Well, anyhow, on September 6th, so that's 5 days after the shootdown, the Reagan administration went so far as to present a doctored transcript of the intercepts that we had between Russian ground control and the pilot. Okay? And Snyder points out in his book, and he was in charge of the TV production, he says, you know, the tape ran for 50 minutes, but we were only given 8 minutes and 32 seconds.
Mm.
He says his job was the perception we wanted to convey is that the Soviet Union did a cold-blooded, barbaric act, okay? So, here's a decade later, Snyder sees the complete transcripts, including the portions that the Reagan administration had hidden, and now he realizes that he was part of this presentation, which was false. Now, did the Soviet fighter believe that he was pursuing a spy plane? Of course he did. It's shown in the intercepts that were suppressed. Was it dark? Could he identify? No, he couldn't. Did he circle the KAL airliner and tilt his wings and all that kind of stuff? Yeah, of course he did. But that didn't matter. What they wanted to say was the U.S. that the USSR deliberately shut down this thing, knowing that it was a passenger aircraft. Now, what is the what's the conclusion that Snyder brings from all this? I mean, does he apologize? Does he express a little chagrin that he was
used,
was bamboozled, just like everybody? No. What he says here is this. Let's see, I got a quote here in front of me if I can find. Yeah, he said, this is the lesson he drew from the incident. Quote, the moral of this story is that all governments, including our own, lie when it suits their purposes. The key is to lie first. End quote. Okay. So whoever lies first wins. And that, you know, it was a flashback to that set of circumstances that I was, so to speak, on active duty when all that happened. And as I say, the book makes it clear what really went down. But, you know, 12 years after or 10 years after, who cares? You know, you blacken the Russians. And,
right.
And you win the game because whoever lies first wins. So I think that's what we have here. And I think this is consequential, Bert, not only because of our relationship with the West and the East Europeans now. You know, it's very akin to how the Russians exerted influence in Eastern Europe in the heyday of the Soviet Union.
Absolutely.
We've got a lot of people in there that depend so totally on us that they're willing to not only regurgitate our propaganda, but to act on it. And so for the first time, and this is big for me, for the first time since the Berlin Wall fell, there's a danger that people who are rather wet behind the ears, who are kind of naive about these things, are willing to risk a firefight with Russian troops in Ukraine without realizing the escalation potential here, because... Well, you know, not only Russia, but the Soviet Union and all Russian governments going back to Catherine the Great at the time of our own revolution, they considered that part of the world their preserve. And as you know, Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union.
Oh, yeah.
And they're only ice-free naval down there. So when people say, well, you know, the Soviets are a little sensitive, or the Russians are a little sensitive,
well, yeah,
this is the backyard. It's not their backyard. It's their front yard, okay? It's where Napoleon, it's where Hitler, it's where all the guys come in, at the front yard, and they're just not going to stand for it. And they told us way back in 2008, when there were rumors that NATO was going to try to get Ukraine and Georgia into NATO, they told us, in no uncertain terms, and I have the cable, thanks to Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks, a cable from Moscow, in which our ambassador says, I just talked with the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, who is still the Russian foreign minister, and he said, I hear rumors about you incorporating Ukraine in NATO. You know what yet means? Yet means yet.
Right.
And to his credit, Bill Burns, our ambassador, sent the cable back, and he titled it Lavrov, Russian Red Line on Ukraine in NATO: Yet Means Yet. And he warned. He warned the U.S. Policymakers that, look, the Russians take this really seriously. What Lavrov said is, if you try this, there's going to be a civil war in Ukraine.
Hmm.
And we will have to decide, we Russians will have to decide whether we have to intervene or not. Those were his words.
Wow.
And that's a cable that's right there in the WikiLeaks trove of documents. So this is a big deal. Now, the follow-up, of course, was that was the 1st of February 2008, right?
Yes.
Now, on the 2nd of April, at a NATO summit, the very top leaders of NATO decided in Bucharest, quote, Ukraine and Georgia will become part of NATO, period, end quote. Why? You know, why? This violated agreements after the Berlin Wall fell, where we told Gorbachev, look, you let Germany become part of NATO, we'll make sure it doesn't get a nuclear weapon under its own independent authority. You withdraw your troops out of Eastern Germany. The troops there were 150,000, okay? You get them out of there, and we promise not to move NATO an inch eastward toward the Soviet, Russian frontier.
Wow.
We violated that promise. We keep on the record. Jim Baker made that promise, and we have our ambassador, Jack Matlock, who was there, attesting to that. We told the Russians we would not take advantage of the fall of the Berlin Wall, and of course we did. So, you know, I talked with one of Gorbachev's aides. He's a professor now in one of the universities in Moscow, last September, and I said, now, you know, that agreement is very controversial. Why was it not written down? And he said, Ray, we're talking early 1990. The Warsaw Pact still existed. The Soviet Union still existed. No one knew exactly what was going to transpire. So that was part of it. But, you know, the real reason, Ray, the real reason was that we trusted you.
Hmm.
Wow.
Hmm. Hmm. Trust is such a big, important issue, and I can't figure out how the media, the mainstream media, okay, let's face it, a lot of them might be new. They don't know history. They don't know the context of these things, but they were used. The mainstream media was used blatantly by the Bush administration regarding that rush to war on Iraq. The reporters just repeated, they were, as you say, stenographers repeating the lies of the Bush administration. They were intentionally fed misinformation, and they reported it as truth, as facts. How could the media do this again? They surely must be aware, hey, we got bamboozled. We were lied to. Do they not learn that lesson? I don't understand what their motivation could be. Are they just plain lazy? Is that the only explanation? Or is there some sort of fear of actually doing intelligence gathering, of being what we used to call investigative journalism?
Yeah, well, investigative journalism is limited now to maybe a handful or two handfuls of bona fide investigative journalists. Witness the fact that Cy Hirsch, the dean,
yes,
the investigative journalist, now has to go to the London Review of Books to get his investigative reports published.
Hmm.
He's got a contract with the New Yorker. He used to write for the New Yorker.
Oh, yeah.
But now what he has uncovered is so telling about the lies that the Obama and the Bush administration have been telling all these years, that they won't even publish it. Witness the fact that one of my colleagues, my editor really, Bob Perry, P-A-R-R-Y, who uncovered the Iran-Contra scandal, who fingered Ali North, the guy,
yep,
who was a hero for a transitory period of maybe 2 years, came down from AP, worked for Newsweek, and found out that Newsweek wouldn't print what he uncovered with respect to Central America and other things. So what did he do? Well, he did what very, very few others did. His son was graduating from college, and he said, hey, Dad, you know, there's something called the internet. There's something called a a website. Why don't you set up a website and you can just publish your stuff and it'll get out there? So he did, consortiumnews.com, 20 years now. But I had lunch with him yesterday, and he's just so frustrated.
I'm sure.
We're doing all this great work, but it never gets into the mainstream media. It's as though we're blacklisted,
and that's
very frustrating, but we keep at it. So the answer to your question, I think, really is that no one was held accountable for the dismal performance of what we call the mainstream media before Iraq. It was, that the New York Times would take a report from the White House, from, let's say, Condoleezza Rice, on a Saturday morning, publish it on Sunday morning, and then Condoleezza Rice go on all the Sunday talk shows and have Bob Schieffer or someone else ask her, Ms. Rice, we saw this report in the New York Times this morning about aluminum tubes going to Iraq, aluminum tubes that could only be used for gaseous diffusion, for, centrifuges. What do you think about that? And Condoleezza Rice says, oh, I saw that too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're checking that out, but it looks like a really good... That's the way it went. It was just awful. The same thing is happening now. And why? Well, because people like Fred Hyatt, who heads up the Washington Post editorial section, is thriving. It's as though he was... he admitted to the Columbia Journalism Review. He said, we reported things before Iraq as flat fact that turned out to be lies. If they weren't flat fact, we probably should not have represented them as flat fact. well, yeah, I suppose. Gosh. So this guy is still waving the flag for the neocons, whether it's against the treaty with Iran or whether it's to use force against Ukraine. If you hold no one accountable, and the same is true of the New York Times, then they're free to do it again, and they're proud to do it again.
Yes, and we have been doing it again. And we talked earlier about, the 50s, the image of the Soviet Union not allowing the truth, them controlling the news and the people being kept from reality, kept from the truth, and blacklisting of that same period, and how reporters today might be legitimately afraid to be blacklisted for daring to speak out against the official government handout of the truth. And another, bit of history, back in the early 70s, a lot of people were upset about the Watergate scandal. What upset us was the government was lying to us. And aside from concerns about this specific case, what does this, the apparent mistruths about the shooting down of that Malaysian airline, what does this say about the status of democracy and the ability and tendency of our government to lie to its people? It seems to me it's a heck of a lot worse than it was under Watergate.
Well, it is. And that's the thing that we have to contend with, the more so since, as you know, Bert, peace is not good for business.
Right.
Now, I used to tread softly on mentioning the military-industrial complex. But, even an old guy like me can learn. And I learned, among other things, that Ike, President Dwight D. Eisenhower, wanted to use the phrase military-industrial congressional complex.
My, whoa.
And he was dissuaded, as well, now it's gone on too far. Okay, well, now in spades, you have not only the military-industrial congressional, but you add media, corporate, and security services complex. And you look at that closely, where the mega corporations are pretty much in line with the government and vice versa. And you have something approximating approximating definition that Mussolini gave to fascism. I do not blanch before the word. Okay.
Mm.
So this is very, very serious stuff. Let me give you, I'm from the Bronx, and so we used to say, I'll give you a for instance.
Yeah.
You want a for instance?
Sure, a quick one.
Okay. March 29, headlined article in Washington Post, quote, Putin had early plan to annex Crimea, end quote. Described by the Russians now as a secret meeting that Putin held on February 23, 2014, during which Russia, quote, Russia decided to take the Crimea Peninsula, end quote. Now, what's wrong with that? I asked a bunch of people at Veterans for Peace the other day, like 400 of them. I asked a very progressive group 2 months ago, what's wrong with that? On February 23rd, Putin held this meeting and decided to take the Crimean Peninsula. Well, nobody knows what happened on February 22nd. And February 22nd was the most blatant coup in human history, advertised beforehand on YouTube,
right,
and displacing a duly elected head of Ukraine. So that's where it started, not with the Crimea, not with the meeting that Putin judiciously held the next day.
Hmm.
That's their major naval port, for God's sake.
Yeah.
This is their front yard.
Absolutely.
So, you know, so we have to realize that people who think they're getting information that's accurate from the likes of the Washington Post or the Fox News or the evening newsbookers are not, and they have to seek it out in the fifth estate, which is the internet, the web.
Well, this, yeah, what an era we're living in, and we're trying to keep democracy alive here. Ray McGovern, thank you so much. Very informative, and we have quite a task ahead of us. Thank you so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Well, thanks to you for the role you're playing in doing this, Bert. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Wouldn't it be nice to tell the truth?